to the Development Policy Centre podcast. In an increasingly results-driven development agenda, an adaptive approach to programming holds potential for improving effectiveness. In this podcast from the 2018 Australasian Aid Conference, a panel of donors, implementers and consultants speak to the importance of adaptive programming, its implications and its challenges. We hope you enjoy this podcast.
Okay, sorry everyone, I thought we might make a start. We're a little bit late starting off this morning. Thank you all for joining us for our panel presentation on adaptive management from theory to practice. I know that all the bios are listed up on the website, but I wanted to just go through our eminent panel and just give you a quick highlight of who we've got here with us today, who'll be sharing their thoughts and perspectives on their experiences and working in adaptive management programs. So we have a very esteemed thinker from the Thinking Working Politically School of Thought, or if that's what we call it, or the New Orthodoxy, however you'd like to describe it, Graham Teske, who is the Principal Technical Lead on Governance at Abt Associates and has a long track record working in development. Before that, worked for the Department for International Development in the UK, across the world. So I asked everyone to send me fun facts about themselves to liven this up. Graham wrote back and said there was absolutely nothing fun or interesting about him, and that he was middle England, middle class and middle everything. So I think we can agree that especially that last point is far from the truth, and many of us are here to hear his interesting, very insightful opinions and experiences on this topic. We also have now our Ben French, who's the public sector governance portfolio lead at Oxford Policy Management and a work colleague of mine. He joins us here from the UK. Ben has worn different hats as well. He also has worked on the donor side of things, worked for the Department for International Development in Pakistan before, and before that was an ODI fellow in South Sudan. He also has a fun fact that he has set up ultimate frisbee teams in many of the countries he's lived in, including South Sudan and Pakistan. Which is a great way, I think, to get to know people. We have Nicola Follis joining us here, who is the partner for the Asia-Pacific region for Palladium. Before that, Nicola headed up Palladium's governance practice in the UK, and she's worked in many areas, sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia and the Caribbean and the Balkans, but has recently now just moved to Brisbane and calls Australia home and is fresh off the boat. So welcome, Nicola. And last but not least, we have Saku Akmimana, who's the Principal Specialist of Governance at DFAT, who's here. Saku did warn me that she's not a morning person, but that's all right, she's here on time, so that's great. And Saku, you know, leads the thinking on this, you know, political economy analysis and this way of working within DFAT. And before that, she worked at the UN and the World Bank, primarily in South and East Asia. Fun fact about Saku is that despite the fact that she's worked in refugee camps in Mozzie domes with no water, she would explain her greatest challenge to date is moving to Canberra and having to drop her 13-year-old daughter off to the Gungahlin Aquatic Centre on a Friday evening, followed by early morning start at 6 a.m. at the lake for dragon boating. So, yeah, that's our panel that we have here today. So our structure today, we're not giving presentations, we're having more of a Davos-style conversation. And just to impose some structure, because I felt uneasy about just an hour and a half of talking, which is what it actually will be, we're just going to split it up into three main sections. And so there'll be about 20 minutes panel conversation, followed by 10 minutes Q&A for each of those sessions. So it'll be a bit more interactive, I think. So today we're all here to talk about, you know, how we can find ways to implement flexible programming within the context of a more increasingly results-driven agenda. And we're trying to figure out how we can potentially overcome the challenge of adaptive management to have the capacity and the authority to both respond and adapt to things that are happening on the ground as we start implementing. And so to talk about some of the three key challenges that we'll be discussing today will be, one, this issue about failing fast and learning quickly and adaptation. The second one, we'll be looking at the challenges to getting the team right for adaptive management and the people who can work in this way the most effectively. And thirdly, we will be discussing building partnerships of trust between implementers and governments and where you're working, the context in which you're working. So first of all, we're going to start off with failing fast and learning quickly, which is one of the key challenges, is how to build learning and reflection and adaptation into this way of working. And to start us off on that topic, I'll invite Graham to kick us off. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Ali. Good morning, everybody. I know that some of you have out there do this pleasure of listening to me before, But for those of you that haven't, let me just explain why I sound like I do. It's now 17 years since I was working for TIFID in Kampala, where I was identified with what the doctors told me was advanced, aggressive and, in their words, incurable throat cancer. So they had to take away my vocal cords and put in this little bit of plastic, which enables me to talk. So please, I would ask you to bear with me. But if I say anything that you don't quite understand, i.e. you don't hear the words rather than make any sense of what I'm saying, just ask me to repeat it. I'm used to it by now. Okay, thank you, Ali. Let's talk about... I want to focus particularly on the learning aspect of this phrase, learning quickly and failing fast. I want to approach it in a slightly unusual way, in the sense that for those of you that have worked in the area of public service reform, capacity development over the last 20 years, you will recognise what has now become a sort of a conventional way of assessing the chances of success, and that's looking at all the at three levels, the institutional, the organisational, and the individual. And in public service reform, public service management, capacity building, capacity development, whatever you call it, the general consensus is that external partners are not bad at making progress at the individual level, providing training, providing kits, helping the individual understand their job. Donors aren't bad actually at the organisational level, helping with top evaluation grading, spans of control, organisational structure, you know, long-term vision, all that sort of stuff. But the real weakness in trying to bring around sustained change in public service management, organisational development, is the institutional, the rules of the game, the incentives that motivate and animate. So that threefold level of analysis, the institutional, the organisational, the individual, is a conventional way of assessing PSR. And as I say, the conventional wisdom is, it's at the institutional level that we're failing. My view on adaptive management, and this is basically from the last 2 years working on three large multi-sector facilities in Papua New Guinea, Indonesia and Timor-Leste, which were designed along PDIA lines. My judgment is that the reverse of those conclusions about PSR apply. I think the incentives are there, but it's at the organisational and at the individual level that we fail completely. One of the aspects of my job is to look at documents coming out of TIFID, coming out of TFAT, and even coming out of the World Bank that are seeking contractors. So I have the pleasure of reading them and, in some cases, helping prepare our proposals. Virtually every one of the documents that I've seen in the last couple of years, they're all demanding a PDIA, adaptive management, thinking and working politically approach. They want the design and the implementation to reflect these ideas. In my discussions with TFAT in Canberra, the people that are responsible for the theology of the organisation, its processes, how progress will be judged, they are all convinced that adaptive management has got an important role to play. They argue that all their internal processes allow adaptation in implementation. So I think the incentives are there. The institutions that would encourage contractors, implementers like ourselves, and at the oversight agencies and individuals in organisations like TFAT, they want PDIA, adaptive management, to work. So the incentives are in place, but in my experience, they've not translated into organisational initiatives or individual competence or capability to learn and actually put Peter I.A. into place. Let us just explain that a bit more. Let's look at the organisational level. The key thing, the one overwhelming, defining feature of adaptive management is that three things are done simultaneously. You implement, you monitor, and you learn. Unless those three things are brought together, then you're never going to have a PDIA, adaptive management approach. So your organisational structure has got to bring together the responsibility for delivering the activity, monitoring it, and learning from it. And even in, I'm not sure I should say this, but even in the programmes where I work, for some reason that I fail to understand, monitoring is linked with evaluation and separated out to a little bunch of people that live at the far end of the corridor. And if you ask your implementers for data, how their programme is going, what's causing success, what's causing failure, they will invariably say, well, that's not my responsibility. The monitoring people do that. And that structure is replicated in our development partners, in GFAT, in DFID, in the bank. The responsibility for monitoring and evaluation. First of all, they're two completely different things. They're lumped together and separated out. So there's a real organisational imbalance in the way we think about structuring our responsibilities to give our adaptive management even the remotest chance of success. So that's at the organisational level. And I think at the individual level, in many ways, it's even more complicated. And this comes on to the second question about, well, it's got implications for the second question about getting the teams right. If you think about what are the skills required if you are going to implement, monitor, and learn, they are very, very demanding.
Sorry, Graham, I might interrupt you there because we're going to talk about that at length in the next section.
Can I have one more minute to finish?
I was going to say the failings.
What you require at those individuals, they've got to be able to analyse. They've got to be able to understand what's going on. So it's analytical skills. Then they need to assess what are the implications of what's going on. How do we know what's happening, what the implications are? And finally, they've got to be able to adapt. They've got to reach a judgment about the extent to which they need to change. They are remarkably complex skills, and we expect our programme implementation staff to be able to do that. Thank you.
And I was just going to ask, do people acknowledge their failures, or how do you, or any of you, feel that with this adaptation, it means you need to, with this portfolio approach to this way of managing, admit when things aren't going right? I mean, has everyone got experience of where that's happened and track has been changed? I don't know, Saku, do you feel that this is something that has happened in the programs that you've worked on?
Or before I get to donor, that, yeah. I think I have something to add to what Graham said, and that is this: the whole idea of adaptive management and the PDIA model is around learning. Learning is at the centre, experimentation, learning, adaptation. And the whole idea came out of the work that Lance Pritchard did on capability traps. And it's looking at the process of national development. And in those processes, you know, these happen over long periods of time. There's an endogenous feedback loop from the experimentation to the adaptation. There's a political system, a political and administrative system that responds. And we're trying to mimic that somehow in a compressed program project cycle with something that is, you know, externally imposed. So some of those ideas, you know, are going to be very hard to implement because we don't have that endogeneity of the feedback loop and the biggest development story of our lifetimes, China pulling billions out of poverty. At the centre of that is an extraordinary learning culture within the Chinese Communist Party, which basically had thousands of labs of experimentation with clear high-level development outcomes at the top, and some accountability structures from the centre. So again, I think we have to have some humility and modesty in terms of what we can do through a project. I agree with all the points that Graham makes. But you know, I think the best we can really do in term is define some clear high level objectives, and those should be relatively modest, because again, you're not going to have transformative change in a 5-year, even a 7-year project. What you can do, though, is you can be there when big stuff might happen, when a crisis might happen, when some extraordinary, when something shifts, an equilibrium shifts, and you have an opportunity to do something big. And there you're there, and you have the relationships, and you can act. So I'm just suggesting that, yeah, the project model and our bureaucratic modalities are still, you know, lagging way behind the thinking.
Yeah. Maybe if I could come in from the angle of back in the governance portfolio I managed in the UK, we had about 8 programmes which were at varying degrees of maturity, and we're all trialling adaptive management approaches in different ways, and all faced their own challenges and had different contexts. The sort of granddaddy of them all was the State Accountability and Voice Initiative programme in Nigeria. Helen Derbyshire up there was very involved in that, and a lot of the learning that we had was coming out of some of the experience they had over 8 years. And I think one of the things we find, I completely agree that creating learning forums for program teams is important. I really liked Graham's point about the separation out of M&E and technical and operational. We find that a really key factor was enabling a team to work together as a whole, bringing them together. And often a lot of the challenges were actually operational program management, not just technical, or bringing them all together into forums where they could really thrash out what was emerging from evidence, what this meant for adapting work plans, adapting theories of change, and so on. I think more recently we've had a couple of programs where we've been looking at the problem of license to fail, which is very complex actually in the current environment. In a lot of, here in Australia, certainly in the UK, there's political pressure in the external public domain. We find in some programs which they've tended to be the smaller ones, which are a little bit under the radar, which have been set up to test and these kind of approaches. We've been trying out some things like building into the results frameworks actual indicators around failing. Actually, it's okay to fail, providing you do it quickly and you learn from that. That's one program we've got that's doing that. That's not possible in all, but it was an interesting sort of approach. And I think also really clear delineation of decision-making authority. I'm getting into a topic that we'll come to later, but agreeing with our donor partners and so on. When do we make decisions about when we stop, when we start, when we adapt? How much resources are going into that? We've trialed some things around allowing ourselves a little bit of flexibility with smaller, up to certain budget ceiling, to test, to pilot, to scope. But beyond that, if we're going to invest in something a bit more, it has to be approved with more in-depth theory of change analysis and so on. So these are all things we're trialing, but yeah, it's definitely an evolving sort of feast, and I very much agree with both of what Saku and Graham are saying in that regard.
So the downside of coming at the end of this sort of conversation is that everyone said all the good things. I think the thought that goes through my mind, and I've been reading quite a bit about growth mindsets recently, and so just to sort of change the context, but if you think about it, as children, we're sort of encouraged to fail, and you're incentivized to fail up to a certain extent, and then we start to change that in our education system and start to say, no, you need to get an A+, you shouldn't experiment, you should... And we do the same thing with our development programs. I asked all of the sort of OPM teams that are talking about adaptive programming and growth, and sort of doing these things differently, and it was fascinating that they all came up with different things, but the big challenge always seemed to be, how do we build a growth mindset into our team? How do we build this mindset that says, actually, it's okay to screw up? And it's okay to screw up and then admit that we've screwed up. Because actually, there's a lot of psychology that says, as human adults, we do not like to admit that we've made a complete and utter mess of something. And we have a really difficult time accepting that. So, failing fast and accepting that we then need to learn quickly is a great concept, but it's actually something that we're hardwired not to do. And then on top of that, when we started thinking about this thinking and working politically, we actually hire people and we say, please invest your political capital, your social networks, in making a project work. Oh, and by the way, in 5 years, it might not be around and you'll be completely screwed over because it didn't work. So how do we manage that process, right? They have a massive incentive not to fail, to minimize their risk, minimize their exposure. At the same time, we know that actually if we're not encouraging failure, we're not going to find the solutions that actually enable success. So I looked at one of our programs that actually does set up the PDIA framework really effectively, and it's making some really good progress, and it does the implementation, it does the monitoring, it does the rapid learning, and it's actually closed down a few of their projects. It's called MUVA, and it's in Mozambique. You can look it up. It's a really cool project. But the key point about that was I asked the team, what makes it successful? And there was absolutely no agreement on what was happening in the program that made it successful. Some people thought, okay, it's the fact that we build in the theory of change. Some people said, no, it's the way we've structured the team. Some people said, the M&E person, of course, said, no, it's the monitoring and evaluation and learning cycle. And my personal view is that we have a fantastically dynamic and enthusiastic and committed team leader who's desperate to make this work, and she is just bashing people's heads together until it's acceptable to fail, which brings us sort of into the next conversation, yeah. So I'll pause there. But that's just a sort of a reflection for me.
Well, I was going to say I'm failing totally at timekeeping on this panel, but that's fine. I think it's a good discussion anyway. But now, if anyone has any questions, we've got time for about 3 or 4 questions, if anyone would like to jump in now. Just raise your hands, and if you can tell us your name and who you're representing today, that would be great.
That was really interesting. I wanted to pick up on the point that you made, Ben, about partners and bringing in partners who have personal incentives not to fail. Sorry, my name's Caitlin. I work at DFAT, but be completely open and say I'm a contractor, so I'm one of those people that has one of those incentives not to fail. And I've been involved in projects which have failed fast before and watched my contract disappear into a puff of smoke. Do you think, because the environment that we work in now is very dynamic between how donors operate and how implementation teams operate, and there's a lot of work that goes into how we structure implementation and contracts and all that sort of jazz, Is that one of the main? Do you think that that's one of the main challenges that incentive for between donors and implementers to maintain those financial relationships, which is obviously a challenge that AIDS worked with for a long time. But do you think that this mindset is really coming up against that problem, particularly for NGOs who have limited resources, and when they get involved in these projects, they can't necessarily invest in projects that might fail as much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you want to do
that? Then I'll let you take that one. Yeah, maybe you answer that one, and then the microphone can be up at the back. I think I saw another question up the back. Yeah. There's two at the back. Yeah, perfect.
So I mean, I think, and I suspect that the other panelists have views on this as well. I mean, Graham started by saying it's not just about, that we've actually, the incentives, the theology that's coming out of donors is not necessarily wrong. It's positive, and it's positively encouraging this. I think it's a much more subtle issue, and it's interactions at different points, right? So if you're a civil servant, your career is made by progressing and demonstrating successful programming and showing that you can manage upwards, that ministers don't get hacked off because something's gone wrong and they have to be dragged in front of parliament. So the incentives within the civil service, not what theoretically the civil servants want to do, but the incentives don't necessarily support that. So it takes somebody in the civil service who's determined to make it work. I also take somebody in the supplier relationship, and we're going to come on to that, I think, in the sort of third question, but who can have trust with the donor to say, actually, look, this is not working. We need to find a way. So I don't think it's the structures. I'm actually looking across OPM's projects. Every single one of our adaptive programs has a completely different structure. So, and some of them are phenomenally traditional log frame structures. So it's not that the structure is important, it's the people within it and the ability to manage those dynamics, I think.
I think there are 2 more questions up the back, and then we can move on to people.
Hi, thanks very much. My name's Annie Major from Adam Smith International. I'm really interested in this session because we do a lot of market systems development programs, as you know, and I think there are a range of players in the room who have been applying similar principles in these types of projects and others for many years. So from a program perspective, I think there's been a lot of adaptation already applied during implementation. My question builds a little bit on the one before in terms of your views on the extent to which donors, I guess at a strategic level, are ready for and flexible to deal with this type of programming, particularly in political pressured environments, and whether it's realistic within short program timelines for them to be able to accept and support this way of programming.
I think in preparation for this panel, we had a little bit of an exchange, and none of us had ever seen a bet, a small bet that had been dropped because it was failing. And so, you know, we have adopted the rhetoric and the language, but I think, as Ben said, at the individual level, but even at the program level, you know, because a lot of these projects. You know, have people who are working on these and genuinely think, if only we have another 6 months, or if only we have this agenda may get some traction. So, I mean, I'm wondering whether we actually think about performance metrics for, you know, a positive tick for the number of issues that you drop, that you say these are dead ends, that we positively incentivize that, you know, amongst project implementers. I'm a little bit more, but less optimistic than you, Ben, on whether we've really got it right in terms of incentives. I still think that in donor agencies, and this is both at DFAT and the World Bank and other bilaterals, that that staff incentives, certainly in the donor, are still too focused on project preparation and design rather than implementation. And all of it, certainly in my experience at the bank, getting something through the board, that's it, you know. You move on and your success in implementation catches up, and never catches up with you, because the evaluation happens like 8 years later. And you're already, you know, somewhere else. And so, I mean, I think bilateral environments are more accountable, but in that sense. But I still think that it's the front end of projects that the focus is on.
So I'm just bearing in mind in time. I mean, we can have one more question, or we can move on to people. All these questions, it's fabulous. We might have just one more question here, and then we'll move on, and there will be two more times for questions later, and it doesn't matter if we, ask questions later that are about everything. Yeah. Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay, yep, thank you.
Morning. My name is Hamish Nixon. I work on decentralization and citizen participation in Papua New Guinea, and I'm one of the people that Graham can't understand why I'm unable to create programs that monitor, implement, and learn at the same time.
Excellent.
I think one of the reasons why is that the problem specification that we often use to have this conversation is a bit of a straw man. It tends to focus on a simple kind of assessment of what we're trying to do, which is there's a donor and they would like to achieve development outcomes, and there's an implementer and they would also like to achieve development outcomes, and they're having a little bit of a tug of war about how much freedom versus how much accountability should exist. And I don't think that describes most bilateral aid relationships and projects at all, or very well. It doesn't describe multilateral ones particularly well either, and that there may be a clue in that why we see some of the success of these programs popping up in NGOs and fairly autonomous organizations. What's missing from the straw man is two or three things, probably more, but One is that a very big, important strand of the aid relationship that has developed over the last two decades or so is the ownership and partnership strand, in which the beneficiary country, and in particular the national government and ministers of the beneficiary country, I wouldn't be referring to PNG at all here, are a very important part of that relationship, and what they think about what you're trying to do is important. And fairly pie-in-the-sky ideas about being adaptive and flexible may not sound the same to the beneficiary as they do to the practitioner. Secondly, those bilateral aid projects are a means of brokering political and conceptual relationships between national-level politicians in the donor country and national-level politicians in the recipient about what governance means, what gender means, what economic development means, and a whole set of things which aren't really determined by the same kind of criteria of what a development outcome is that, again, practitioners or experts might use. And the third is that the implementers and the donor officials are prospectors in the sense of prospect theory, and they are in the perfect definition of a situation that creates risk aversion in behavioral economics, because they see very high quantifiable potential losses to when things go pear-shaped and very uncertain minimal gains when things go well. And so you would expect those people, and I think the implementers equally like a quiet life, to behave in ways that give them a quiet life in preference over ways that are likely to turn things upside down. And those dimensions, I think, shape especially the institutional and organizational incentives, but some of the individual ones as well.
Thank you for that question and that series of comments. I mean, I think that actually leads quite nicely into our next session, you know, just talking about people and what kinds of people work most effectively in this way. You know, there's phrases about development entrepreneurs, you know, people who can work in that context and have those conversations and have those relationships, but also cut those relationships if they need, which I think is a very hard one. So, is that all right if we then maybe take your comments and address them as we go for this next section, because we're really over time now. Cool, so now we'll move on to the next section on people and getting the team right. And maybe Nicola might want to kick us off on this one and you guys have been approaching that.
So the angle I wanted to bring to this, maybe I'm not the best person to go first, but from a very practical perspective, I think others will talk about some of the characteristics that make up are needed in teams like this. You know, you talk about development entrepreneurs, there's all kinds of literature on this, but in a very practical sense, what we find is, when we were having our previous discussion prior to this workshop, someone said, very rarely do you get team, I think it was Graham, very rarely do you get the team right from the beginning, and I completely, that's been very much the experience. And often, when you're, as a supplier, when you're preparing a bid, there's very clear criteria that you need to follow in order to score well against the team section. That doesn't necessarily marry with what's going to work in practice in terms of an individual, particularly at the team leader level or the senior roles. And I'm quite interested here. I've seen in DFAT context, there's been a few things that have come out recently where the team hasn't had to be on the ground from the beginning. They're recruited in inception, and I hadn't come across that before. I think that's a wonderful idea because it allows space to get the right people. One of the things that we find really important is, and it's actually Savvy that trialed it, but we've been experimenting with it further in other programs, competency-based recruitment. So not just recruiting on skills, technical skills or process skills, but also on actual competencies, behavioral things. So I know the Savvy program, they did a lot of work as a team, and this was actually in the middle of implementation a few years in. It wasn't from the beginning. But to really think through, if we're going to work in this adaptive way, what kind of values, what kind of behaviors, and they articulated it as a team vision, mission, which flowed down into values, and then how they would live those values. And that work was then used to inform recruitment interviews, performance and management of team members, induction, you know, setting out clear expectations, and also capacity building, because a lot of people who may have come on board may have had the inherent capabilities, but just needed some, you know, skills in applied PA or facilitation, whatever it might have been. And so there was all kinds of things like that. So we find that integrated approach to people management, the management systems, was really critical in addition to trying to find the right people and out there. And I think another thing I would say is looking in unconventional places. In a recent program we had in Tanzania, DFID, our client, was like, you know, go and look in, you know, don't just advertise for people who've worked in development programs. And so we went out, and actually in our adverts, we said, you know, you do not have to have experience in a development program. And we got some amazing people through that. We have two people on that team who are real stars. They had political antennae, they had just this entrepreneurship sort of skill, and they just translated over really easily. So those are just some of the things we're finding in practice. It's not an exact science, it's difficult, but and every program will be different, but yeah.
It's a lovely
that's,
ringtone.
That's
though.
Telling me to stop talking.
And so you wouldn't say that looking for these sorts of development entrepreneurs or the people that are getting the team right, that they're not total unicorns that don't exist, that we're not kind of trying to find a combination of skills and people who are so self-critical that they're willing to admit failure, but, you know, work well in teams, but also, I mean, for me it's always that element of that self-reflective element that's excellent, but hard and challenging and then might make you just question everything. You know, if you start going down that little train of thought too much, then you might just find like it's all too hard and it's all, you know, that kind of thing. So I'm not sure if anyone, do we feel like they're unicorns or we've found people like that that really exist? Maybe Ben or Graham?
Go ahead, Ben.
I'll just make 3 points on getting the teams right. And I agree that it's a really challenging thing to do. First point, in the programs that I've been working on, it's taken us a while to get the right senior management in place. However good they are on paper before when you put your bid in, of course, one, A, never knows that they're absolutely going to turn up, and B, one never knows whether their interpersonal dynamics will work as a team. And also with the person in charge, you need a mix of a strategic vision as well as operational management, and they're sometimes difficult to get in the same person. So senior management is a continuing challenge. Second point about teams, it's interesting that we all genuinely want a greater role for nationals in our teams. They've got the relationships, they've got the networks, they understand the country in a way that outsiders never ever will. But then again, I'm going to speak bluntly. When it comes to assessing the performance of contractors, my sense is that DFAT, and I don't know about DFAT at the moment, but I'm not convinced that DFAT value it. They value the elegant minute with no typographical errors. And often that is not what people working in their second, third or fourth language can offer. So sometimes we have had rows with our funder about our staffing portfolio, our staffing profile. So that mix of nationals and non-nationals can be tricky. And then the third thing comes back to organisations. If we are going to merge the monitoring, the learning and the implementation, then you've got to make sure that you co-locate resources and responsibility. You can't separate them out. You've got to make sure people know what their responsibilities are and they've got the authority and the resources to do it.
Thank you.
I mean, it sort of follows on from that. I guess when I was thinking about teams, the first thing that came to mind was that none of us disagreed that the team mattered, but none of us could really think of examples. There's some examples, but none of us could think, actually, there's this one way we've done it and that we really just get it right every time. It's sort of this hodgepodge. So we were sort of all in agreement that this was really important, but none of us actually could think of how, you know, how if you could distill it to two or three things that actually worked, there wasn't anything. So I think that's a point in itself. And I guess it's more of a challenge to the room. I mean, one is, especially with big consultancy firms, and the sort of supplier contractor model, the way aid is done through that model, does that actually work and lead to adaptive programming? So it's a big question I have. You know, should we have more staff who are technically internal? We manage them ourselves. We can make it easier to co-locate. We can build teams over longer periods of times across projects because they're not all contracted for that specific project. Or is there another way of doing it, the competency-based type of recruitment? But that leads to a challenge to the donors as well. I can't think of very many technical proposals that I've written where the team hasn't been one of the most highly scored parts of the proposal. So you're building in an incentive to the supplier to find the best CV that looks the best, that ticks all the boxes. Whether that person is actually going to be brilliant or not, that doesn't really matter. So I think, and I think DFAT does it a bit differently with their interview-based approach as well, but I definitely think in the DFID market, that's a huge problem. And you're seeing some adaption and some change, but you know, on one side, you have suppliers who have an incentive because of, you know, there's fund flow risk and so on, to not necessarily take on large staff costs and to build staff over a long period of time. And on the other hand, you have a donor that's not creating a strong incentive to build adaptive teams to say, actually, it doesn't matter what your team is at the beginning. We want to see your, you know, competency-based approach to recruitment and how that's going to work to bring that in. And I guess my last point, and it's going to link into the partnership thing, but it's also a challenge, I think, to all of us, is that we tend to look for technical experts. And development is a very highly, academic, technical sort of discipline. We like to write about it. We like to write about political economy analysis. We like to write about thinking and working politically. But I haven't seen too many development professionals who are actually great influencers. The soft skills of being a politician, of being a diplomat, aren't necessarily the same as being a good academic and being a critical partner and a critical examiner. But when we talk about adaptive programming and the sort of working closely with country governments, what we're actually talking about is having an agenda, saying this is actually what we're trying to achieve, and actually influencing and working towards it. And so maybe a silver lining in the sort of increasing alignment between foreign ministries of foreign affairs and development agencies is there are some skills that can be shared from the political beast into the development beast. And I sort of speak of that from a little bit of personal experience because I had to wear both hats when I worked in Lahore. But it's just there's sort of more challenges to the room because I think we need to be more critical about ourselves when it comes to how we structure teams and can we actually get it right.
Maybe Saga might just bring you in here to talk about like donor ways of working and even, I guess, approaches to the program management of these types of ways of working. I mean, Nicola touched on the fact that this is a very hands-on, very dynamic, you know, there's a lot of facilitation, a lot of other skills that come into program managing these types of jobs, but when we bid for any of this type of work, program management is not something that DFAT might even want to pay for. You know, that might just come out of a general management fee or, you know, but it's actually a skill, especially in this way of working, I would say, and helping locking this, adaptive management. I wonder if you have anything to touch on about that, about donors' ways of working in this space. You can write any donors.
Like I have. We can talk about any donors.
Not DFAT.
I do think, I mean, Graham's point about national staff and how we tap into that expertise and not put a premium on beautifully written documents, etc. I agree 100% with that. But I mean, I also think that this expectation of one person having this mix of skills is a real, it is problematic. And I was really happy to hear Nicola's comment about recruiting people from outside development, because in a lot of these contexts, especially sitting in a Ministry of Finance, the classic kind of ODI fellow type profile of a young person who's who doesn't have vast experience in their home country on a set of issues, who just goes in there, who wants to learn, who is adaptable, and who basically adopts the host government's kind of identity because they're technically employees of the host government.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the sort of, and who uses the soft skills leading from behind, who may not be the great technical expert, but of course knows how to draw on that technical expertise if that's required. Yeah. Those are the sorts of, those are the sorts of people or the sorts of sets of skills that we often want in these projects.
Yeah.
But they don't often find their way because of the points that Ben
made about, you know, in order to win a bid.
You need 10 years experience, yeah, at least.
So I think, yeah, I think there's still quite a mismatch.
Thank you. Right, I thought we might open up for questions now. Right, shall we start on this side? Because I was really mean. I was favouring that side last time. Okay, so we'll start here. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm Sam Chittick. I'm the country representative for the Asia Foundation in the Philippines, and I have the pleasure of working on a program called the Coalitions for Change, which some of the people in the room here have interacted with over the years. A couple of observations. One on that last point, or Ben's point. I don't think that the role of the development practitioners in this context is the doers. I think it's really a facilitation role. So if you translate that into our context in the Philippines, we have at the moment 14 reform agendas that are going on under one umbrella program. It's my job and the job of our team to manage the structures, the reporting. But we have 14 teams that are all led by Filipinos with, you know, passions and connections and networks, the basic ingredients that go into the successful reform. And it's really our job to make the resources and the support necessary for them. And there's a mentoring and a guiding role in that as well. But really, if you look at, you know, what goes into achieving reform X or reform Y, we're the minor players. They're the ones who actually lead the work and are there in the front lines every day. So I guess rather than looking and trying to assess whether or not the development practitioners have those skills, I would say that's maybe the wrong question. We should be looking at how we have the skills to facilitate rather than to do. And related to that, Saka made the point earlier about dead ends and failures and so on. I think it was a really interesting discussion. But I think it can be done. Saka, you were saying there's no examples that you can think of. Under the Coalitions for Change, we have seven investments, reforms, whatever, that didn't go anywhere. There's a book that's in production at the moment, written by my colleagues Jaime Faustino and John Seidel from LSE. And I was trying to encourage them to put in a chapter about called Dead Ends, because I think that's a really useful learning process. DFAT are calling it stoppability, which is a horrible word, but captures a really important concept, right? How do you know at what point, or how do you give up at some point and say, we've tried, and we didn't get where we thought we were talking, we didn't get far enough. And so out of that, we can do case studies on seven of those where we invested time and energy and networks and, you know, ask, as Ben was saying, we ask national decision makers and policy makers to invest their capital, and then we have to say, you know, sorry, this didn't work out. But, you know, you can do that because you build up a relationship over time and you have enough capital to be able to do that. So I think there are examples there, but it comes back to creating that architecture and the structure which gives DFAT the confidence that we're investing in the right things in the right way. And we have a frank enough and open enough relationship to be able to say, look, I'm sorry, we started this last year and we haven't got any far enough, or there's a real obstacle that we can't find a way around, so we will take the resources and move on.
Sam, I think that Salka might have a question for you in return. Yep.
What was the reaction from DFAT in those, you know, with those seven cases? I mean, was there incentive for you to say that, to say these are going nowhere, and was the response accepting of it?
DFAT is not uniform, right? So there are different perspectives within. And even, you know, and things change as different, particularly at post, you know, as post offices come in and out, and personalities and perspectives and backgrounds change. Overall, I think it's been a very positive discussion. And when we raise the prospect, and certainly the discussions I've had, when we raise the prospect of ending something, it's never a kind of a wrap over the knuckles discussion. It's a real, oh, okay, so why? And then trying to dig into, you know, what it is and holding us to account for, you know, have you exhausted all the avenues? Have you really thought it through? So I guess it comes back to having the technical depth and confidence to be able to say, you know, yes, we have done all of our work, and yes, we're really, and we haven't just blown your money, but, you know, we tried hard, and we have to be able to demonstrate that, and that's part of the way that monitoring and evaluation comes in. But secondly, having the relationships of trust to be able to say, frankly, you know, we've just spent $140,000 and we didn't get anywhere. You know, sometimes at the level of, you know, the working level in a closed door discussion that works well. In an open forum where we're talking about taxpayers' dollars, it's a much more difficult discussion. And certainly if you then amplify that. Of course, in the reporting, you have the opportunity to contrast that against the successes and all of the good stories. But we haven't found a way internally of telling an effective story around those failures. We're documenting for public consumption an effective story, which is why I was trying to encourage the team to do a chapter on that. But I think collectively, as a group of people interested in these issues, we're also still not very good at that, whether it's called stoppability or whether it's called whatever term we choose, and I hope it's a different term, being able to extract the lessons and present it in a positive way and saying, we spent $140,000 on this, didn't get anywhere, but we've extracted something from it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I'll take two more questions.
Yeah. So as the mic moves around, I just think it's important.
I'll take the two here.
It's worth sort of just saying that, Coalitions of Change is actually a really interesting program. Innova is a very interesting program. Foster is a very interesting program. But they are still the minority of programs. Jamie is a phenomenal individual. I would argue he's a phenomenal influencer of DFAT, of people he works with. He's a facilitator as well, but he is good at selling his message. And I think, so when I talk about influence, I don't necessarily mean you shouldn't be a facilitator as well, but I think it's really important that we start to recognize that we have these programs that we've put up on pedestals and said they work really well, and those programs then become self-reinforcing. You can do more of the good stuff in those programs, but what about the rest of the programs? How do we bring those up? And I worry, I've listened to Jamie speak a number of times, and I'm always quite blown away by how convincing he is and how good he is at influencing DFID and influencing DFAT. And I think that's an important skill, but it's not a skill that necessarily we reflect and think, recognize. Like, managing that relationship is very, very important. So it's just, I completely agree, and I wasn't trying to sort of say we need to be political influencers, but I also think that we need to be careful about saying coalitions of change does all of these things, and we can replicate that in something else, because there are a lot of programs that are trying to do what coalitions of change have done and haven't had the same success. So.
Okay, I want the back and then the blue shirt. Yeah.
Hi, thanks. Ben, you just mentioned Foster, and I was part of a learning process around Foster, and one of the things that struck us with that is what a fantastic national team they had in Nigeria. The program would not have had the success without such a great team. And you spend all this time putting it together, taking 5 years plus out of their careers with no chance for career progression or anything like you would have in a normal organization. And my understanding is after the sort of extensive learning that went on with that in the second phase, they've tried to figure out ways to bring in a much more flexible staffing structure that looks like a proper organizational, a place where the local team can grow, mm-hmm. rather than just taking a big chunk of their working lives out and then leaving them with nothing at the end, in effect. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if you've experienced that in other programs where there's almost been an obligation to the local teams, which it would not be possible to succeed without, mm-hmm. to progress. And I had this as a note for one of the comments about donors, but I think one of the challenges that I'm finding from within, from being within a bilateral agency now, is that most people accept that there's something to adaptive management and believe intuitively. There isn't a great evidence base, and I've got a really dear friend who talks about PDIA, TWP, fanboys and fangirls, and how there's a little bit of a cult around it, and how that might actually stop some of the learning across the organizations, and if there's a way we can think about that.
Yeah. Shall we take a few questions now? Maybe I'll do that, because there's three. There's some very eager hands here. I've got a blue shirt here, and then another blue shirt off the back.
Thank you.
And then there's one over here, too. So three more.
Chris Strout from La Trobe University and Developmental Leadership Program. Danny Roderick wrote an interesting blog recently about the difference between interests and ideas, and he defined interests as congealed ideas. And I'm just wondering what are the congealed ideas that lie behind why this is a problem, this is difficult to do. And I'm just wondering, the principal client notions of accountability seem to be, we're stuck in those. We can't escape. And that then means we have a certain form of recruitment, we have a certain form of evidence that we privilege, we have a certain way of knowing that we privilege. And I guess my question really is, what are the delegitimization of those kinds of ideas that needs to go on for this stuff to really get traction?
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then I'll take the shirt, glasses, and then, I'm so sorry to be so objective. I just don't know.
I just want to say Chris's blue shirt's nicer than mine.
I should have said vibrant patterned shirt. Yeah.
Getting in first. So Mark Moran, University of Queensland. I just want to draw you out. It just seems to me like this is a very kind of in principle conversation that's been going on for a while now, and we really are there examples that are starting to come out where we can do really deep engagements in implementation where some of the adaptations that have occurred and for me, with the limited work that I've done in this area, you really do exceed the outcome expectations when you really dive into this adaptive space, because people are always doing a lot more. It's just not the outcome A. It's, you have to have that as the goal, but you end up doing a bit of outcome B, C, D, and E and F. And mapping that accountability story is exciting and really empowering for the people that are in these adaptive implementation spaces, because they're often sort of doing stuff which is under the radar and they don't feel that they can report on it because the procurement frameworks aren't interested because they're not outcome A. So, are we making any progress on reforming the, I guess through implementation science, if you like, reforming these procurement frameworks that DFAT and other aid agencies are using so that we can really get, fair dinkum about building this evidence base.
Thank you. Yeah, one more question. And we'll have one more question here, please. Yes. And then that'll be four. And then that'll max us out and we will answer.
Hello, my name's Helen Derbyshire. I worked for the SAVI program in Nigeria, which Nicola's mentioned a couple of times, and I also work for the SAVI successor program now, which is called ECP and is part of a bigger program called PEARL. And I think it's quite instructive to compare the experience of SAVI with the experience of ECP and PEARL, particularly in relation to this idea of replicating examples of kind of good practice. So SAVI, a bit like Coalitions for Change in the Philippines, has had quite a kind of high profile, cited as a good example of a program that's making some headway with working in adaptive ways. I'll go through a few little things that we did just to give you some sort of idea. SAVI is a demand-side governance program working in 10 states of Nigeria with civil society, citizens and the media trying to influence state governments. To try and make it work in an adaptive way, decision-making power is decentralized to state teams whose job was to facilitate change as opposed to drive change. We changed our recruitment practices, as Nicola was saying, during the program to move away from technical recruitment to recruitment on the basis of soft skills. We got the frontline teams to work as a team. M&E was part of everybody's responsibility. Quarterly review processes were opportunities to reflect and replan, as well as to report upwards. We had a results framework was based on process-based indicators and outcome mapping, so we weren't driven by results. We revised our log frame 14 times during the course of the program. There was a relationship of honesty and trust built up amongst the state team so that they could reflect where things weren't working and where they were. As our monitoring systems developed, we used our monitoring data for internal reflection purposes as well as for reporting processes, and our central technical team acted as a buffer, so they dealt with the sort of DFID and the supplier demands, leaving the state teams free to deal with what was going on the ground. So we had quite a good model, and I think DFID recognised that model, and in the successor program, learning adaptation, being politically smart, locally led, is absolutely built into the design, which is not built into the design of SAVI. And in the successor program, we have exactly the same team. We have the same technical management team. We have the same advisors. We have many of the same frontline staff. We're yoked in that new program to a supply-side governance program. And the program as a whole is quite high profile in DFID, more high profile than Savvy was. It's got a bigger budget. It's DFID's biggest investment in governance reform globally. And various things are making that a far more constrained environment to work with. So even though we've got the team, we've got the skills, we've got the model, we've got the credibility, we're really struggling to work in an adaptive way in this new program. Partly because we're working with a program that's used to working in a more top-down way and is struggling to adapt its systems. Partly because we've got a higher political profile. Partly because we're linked to a supply-side program, which then gets influenced by the relationship between the British government and the Nigerian government, which then overrides decision-making. And partly because the whole environment in DFID, and I think this is also true in DFAT, is becoming increasingly constrained. So the space we had during Savvy days, where we could have process-based indicators, where we could reiterate our log frame, that's changing. We've got much more demands for specifying outcomes, which constrains the space of our frontline teams. The atmosphere in DFID is much more risk-averse. So I'm just saying that even for us who are experienced, we are struggling with doing this in this current environment. Mm,
very, very interesting. Okay, thank you for all these questions. I think we'll start with Heather's question on fanboys and fangirls around TWP, and PDIA, maybe Graham can take that. And then we can move on to whether we have other examples at OPM of ways we've staffed these programs, a bit like Foster, potentially. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, evidence base. I think all of us would argue that the hallmark of adaptive management is flexibility. And flexibility is in two parts. And that is responsiveness and adaptation. In the programs that I work on and the others I've looked at, I actually think that there is an evidence base for responsiveness. And I think there's a significant body of evidence that shows that if programs are set up at the outset to be responsive to the change of part of the government, then they can meet that function. Where I am less optimistic is in adaptation. And what I understand adaptation to be is a change in the sequencing, the mix, the timing, the activities that are designed to reach some sort of development outcome. As one implements, I've seen much less evidence that teams are alert enough to be able to know in real time when to change, let alone whether to test the donor to see whether resources can be shifted in the way that we would like. So I think there is an evidence base about responsiveness. Adaptation, I'm less convinced about. In terms of Chris and Mark's questions, I'll answer them together if I may, or at least my interpretation of the answer. Chris, you asked what should be delegitimized. And Mark, you were saying what is it that we're accountable for. I think the answer is the same to both questions. I think that implementers, whoever they are, need to be less accountable, and we need to delegitimize in adaptive programming the outcome level. And we need to be far more accountable for three things. The quality of our selection at the beginning. That phrase trips off the tongue. We need to do things that are technically feasible. No, technically desirable and politically feasible. Much of our selection remains focused on what is technically desirable. I've not seen much evidence that formally, at the project selection stage, there's an explicit consideration of what we judge to be politically feasible. So I think that's one area where people like me and APT, and probably OPM and Palladium, we need to be accountable for the activities that we choose. That's what we should be accountable for. Secondly, we need to be much more accountable for the quality of our analysis of why we think a particular course of action will lead to a bunch of outcomes. And there's a big difference between the theory of action and the theory of change, which we won't go into. But we need to understand why we think doing A, B, and C will lead to X, Y, and Z. What's our theory of change? Why do we believe the interests for the change will overcome the interests against us? We need to be accountable for that. And I think that we need to be much more accountable for our decision-taking as we move through the implementation cycle and give us much less accountability for the delivery of the outcome.
Thank you. And then does anyone want to answer Mark Moran's question around accountability frameworks and procurement frameworks within some of the donors, potentially DFAT, and whether they feel like they're responding and changing to some of the elements that we've all spoken about here today? Was that... Yeah, I think I got your question right. Thanks. Thanks a lot.
I can pick it up, but from a sort of putting on my DFAT hat from a few years ago, I think there's just an inherent tension. And I was talking to the UK's Cabinet Office recently, and we were having this fascinating conversation. It wasn't about development, and they were saying, well, one of the biggest things that we do as the implementation unit in the Cabinet Office is we try to get the legal guys and the policy guys to sit down and actually have a conversation when they're trying to change the way they deliver something, the implementation science. Because often what happens is you have a series of policy decisions that are, about adaptiveness, and you have a series of procurement decisions that are not related to that at all. And I think the UK is actually quite a good example of where that sits right now, is that there's been a big rollout over the last 10 years of a new procurement framework across the UK government. It's just starting to hit DFID, and I think it's quite significantly at odds with the wider language within DFID. And, I mean, from a personal perspective, I saw that tension on the ground in Pakistan. You've got a series of procurement rules. This is how we want to deliver it. This is how we need to deliver it based upon the European rules and guidance on procurement. And as development practitioners, this is how we want to deliver it, because this is what we know will deliver the greatest effect. And there are some people, I think, and I suspect, the big programs, Foster is a good example, Foster 1 and SADI. If you think about the environment in Nigeria, I don't think actually DFID's become too much more results-focused than it was when Foster was kicked off. I think that you just had a higher tolerance of risk appetite in Nigeria in the head of office at the time, who was actually quite skilled at managing the dark arts of that procurement tension and that sort of like internal bureaucratic tension and the policy development tension. And I think we need to be really upfront about that. So when I talk about influencing skills, I don't necessarily just mean them in terms of, we should hire development practitioners for our programs who can influence national governments. I actually mean we need the influencing skills in development practitioners within our own organizations. The people who can play the dark arts and who can figure out how to massage a minister at the same time as getting a high-risk development program through. I mean, I think it's amazing to this day that Foster, which is this massive oil and gas program, super high risk, really high profile in Nigeria in the terms of we separate. We don't. The Foster team doesn't believe that they work for OPM. They believe they work for Foster. And there's no OPM branding on Foster, because it's so political, the oil sector, oil revenue management, that it's just not talked about. And I think it's really important to recognize that managing all of those tensions and figuring out how to do it is the dark arts of being a good bureaucrat. And actually, how many development professionals get into DFID or other organizations because they want to be a really good civil servant and manage all the fun Whitehall politics that, everyone loves dealing with the Ministry of Defense, right? So I think it's something we need to acknowledge, that to make these programs work, it's a coalition of a lot of people across a lot of different parts of the sort of development cycle.
I think that brings us nicely to our third session, which we obviously don't have a huge amount of time for, but we're still going to touch on it anyway, which is getting that relationship right between the donor and the contractor, building these relationships of trust so that we have the right people who can have these difficult conversations that Sam was talking about. I mean, Heather, just relating to Foster, I know that the Foster team in Nigeria, they apparently have a weekly or sometimes even a daily phone call from the DFID office to find out what's going on and know when it's appropriate for DFID to step in and when it's appropriate for them not to be at the table. And I think that is, Saku's touched on this, but it's a different way of donors working. It's not just the design of that program, it's being in the nitty-gritty of the implementation, but also knowing when to be part of that and when to step back. And that requires a real level of trust. And so, now I'll just ask the panellists all to touch on that.
on how they think this can be achieved or examples where it has or hasn't. Yeah.
Go for it.
Anyone.
I think, again, trust is earned, and I think it's a two-way street. I think here, and this has been much talked about in other fora, I think, you know, DFAT as the donor has to set the high-level strategic direction of these programs, and then trust the expertise of the implementer. But that's much, much easier said than done. In one instance of one of your facilities, Graham, I saw a sea change when your team leader arrived, and then finally there was a breath, okay, wow, there's a development professional who has extensive comparative knowledge of this field, and you could see the high com kind of, you know, letting it go and trusting the day-to-day, getting rid of the micromanaging because they felt that they were, you know, this was someone they could trust. At the same time, you know, there's been much discussion internally about the skill sets within DFAT and development capability and building that up again in a way that that is able to provide sufficient strategic direction to the contractors, because you know, this is obviously a partnership, and we're all trying to, you know, the North Star is the development outcome, but also doing something, you know, working positively together to that development outcome. And we simply can't do that without, you know, kind of a little bit of role clarity about what this way of working entails and the appropriate skill sets within the donor and the contractor.
Yeah, I would agree completely with all those points. I mean, the trust has to be earned, and we've had similar examples of, you know, a donor getting very involved because they didn't potentially trust the team we had in place. And then when we replaced particular team leaders for someone who they did, you could just see the relationship shifting. So I agree with that very much. I've seen that several times. I think it's interesting to me that it touches on the points a few people have made. A lot of the programs at the minute, where we're actually making a lot of progress, are smaller, or small to medium size, little bit under the radar. I mean, it's what Helen was saying there about the experience in Nigeria. The current program, Pearl, as a large program, really high profile. And, you know, the risk appetite has just shifted because of all kinds of factors. So some of the programs where we're doing some quite innovative work, the advisors within DFID, they've got a bit of capital. They've got a license to let us do that. They've almost built the case internally. And they've created the space for the program because they want the learning out of it, you know, what works, what doesn't. In a bigger program, and also, to be fair, they're very clear that we do have to achieve results, so they're allowing us a little bit of leeway to test, to model through all these sorts of things. But actually, if we're not coming up with some sort of results, that's going to be a problem, and this is where the kind of shared risk and the accountability comes in. Not so common here in this context, but payment by results is a thing that we're really struggling to, in the UK context, to balance with adaptive programming. And some of the sort of shared risk type models we have are things like, you know, not defining outcomes up front, but having, say, a basket of outcomes that potentially could happen. And out of those, if there's 10, you know, potential ones, if we can get two of them, that's where we have hit, you know, the mark. Or another one is where, you know, we've put some, you know, payment by results on an outcome at the very end of the program, but what that actually is not going to be defined until about a year or a year and a half before that stage. So there's various things that we can do to build accountability, to build trust, and so on. But yeah, that relationship is key. And where it works well, it does have an effect on the program. And where it doesn't, again, it can hold the program back.
I think I'd add only one thing to that. If we are going to change the nature of the relationship between the contractor, the implementer, and the donor from one of sort of principal agent to partnership, then trust is absolutely necessary. But as Sacco and Nicola said, it's got to be earned. In my experience over the last couple of years, the issue has largely been around basically staff makeup on both sides. My organisation was establishing programme design and management teams from scratch. Many were employed directly from leaving jobs with DFAT, so they brought those skills and competencies mainly around delivery. So from the word go, we did not have that sort of ability to implement, monitor and learn to get them simultaneously. And DFAT were going through their own change management programme where their staff probably wanted to continue doing what they always wanted to do. So as well as not having that sort of high-level trust, not having an agreement that we're accountable for high-level outcomes and the flexibility adaptive space to manage it all we thought best, we were very much responding to the needs of the funder. And it's absolutely understandable in the context of those three particular programmes. One has now been going for 4 years, one has been going for two, and another has been going for 2.5. And in one particular instance, the degree of transformation in ways of working and the trust relationship is remarkable. In another one, we're halfway down the process, and the third, we're probably a third of the way down, and the responsibility is recognised on both sides. On both sides. But that's very much a work in progress.
I might just bring you in here, Ben, because I know that you've worked for DFID and for OPM on the same project in Pakistan. So you've actually seen both sides up close.
So I don't actually work on that project in Pakistan. I should just clarify that, because that would be a bit of a conflict of interest. I actually just wanted to... So we sort of all agreeing that, you know, obviously partnership really matters, and so I don't think I need to sort of say anything more on that. I think the two points that I wanted to make, and it links to sort of my experience being a political representative in Lahore working on this big subnational governance program, but also representing the UK's national interest, is that a lot of this conversation has focused on our relationship as development practitioners with the countries and the places and the projects that we work on. But I think we need to recognise, and it comes out in some of the comments, that a lot of the people who are contracting us are not necessarily always development practitioners, but they have a massive political economy of their own to manage, and not all of them are always that skilled at doing it. But I think it's really important that we recognise that the world has changed a bit. You know, UK national interest in the DFID market is not going to go away. Obviously, with the merger of AusAid with DFAT, you know, that's become something that's at the forefront. So I think my big lesson in Pakistan was, well, how do you bring the two together? How do you deploy the political savvy of the High Commissioner to help move a program forward, to help unblock something, when your local team says, no, actually, this is an issue where having the High Commissioner say this would make you look better internationally potentially would be a good thing for the Chief Minister to hear. How do you use that sort of more dynamic, more complex relationship to try to actually have more of an impact, to think and work more politically, to build the soft skills, but also to make sure that your team's starting to understand what the constraints to the donor are? So one of my frustrations when I was in the donor world is the lack of understanding from the consultancy team about what my constraints are. What are the deadlines and the pressures that I'm under? And I think that's just as important as recognizing from the donor side what are the constraints that the supplier is under, that we're putting a supplier under. And if we're going to build strong partnerships, the recognition of those types of constraints is as important as, you know, whatever we do to build a shared log frame and so on, because everyone has to feed a beast of some form, you know. Maybe in academia, but even in academia, you have to feed sort of the publication beast, right? So everyone's always feeding a machine and is working to a set of incentives. And the challenge for us as development practitioners is to minimize the perverse and negative incentives, and to maximize the positive incentives to build strong partnerships. And that takes really skilled individuals, but it also takes a huge amount of effort and a focus on things that we often don't see as the primary value. They're not going to be the things that, in the coalitions for change. Sort of building those relationships aren't necessarily the immediate things that you think those are going to deliver the development impact, but those are the things that enable the delivery of development impact longer term. So maybe that's sort of the point on partnership that I would just end on.
Thank you. Okay, I think we have like maybe time for two questions. Depends how short the questions are. Maybe try and keep them short and we can try and get through a bit more. We'll have one here, please. Thank you. And then here and here. Three questions, but please try and keep them short because I've run over. Sorry.
Hi. My name's Minwa Voon from Oxfam. We're now in a phase of experimenting with our ways of working internally and externally at Oxfam. And as part of that, we're working quite closely with various design, tech, and innovation companies. And I think that there's a lot that we can learn, and then I think there's also a lot they can learn from us. And we've already kind of come up against some limitations where, okay, we work in quite different worlds. In your experience, like, have you seen from, like, with these ideas of failing fast and testing and pivoting, I'd be interested to hear from you what you think we can learn from the private sector outside the development world, and maybe what are the limitations, like where we're just going to butt up against a wall.
Cool. Does someone want to start answering that while we get another question, while the microphone goes over?
It's interesting. DFID's doing a lot of thinking, trying to build in agile management, and this MOVA program is one example where they talk about sprints and so on. So I think there is thinking, but more could be done.
Okay, your question.
My name is David Osborne. I'm a research fellow at the Lowy Institute and development economist. So I'd like the panel just to put into their minds the environment we face here in Australia, and to think the question I ask about, and to think about your answer in terms of Papua New Guinea, Pacific Island nations. Ben, you're making some wonderful points about work in other jurisdictions, which are really useful. But the environment we face here is very complex, and the thinking and working politically issue and adaptive programming is something that is very difficult in this environment. So it does, to have adaptive programming and thinking and working politically, it requires a high degree of capacity both on all sides, both in the donor and in the implementing partners. Now, listening to Senator Wong yesterday, I have concerns about DFAT's, or she certainly raised some concerns about DFAT's capacity to deliver or to manage such a complex agenda which you've laid out today. So what I'm interested in is what is the realistic approach in the environment that we actually face here? And listening to Graham talk about the work of ABT Associates in PNG, it's a very complex and difficult environment in where thinking and working politically is occurring every day in the PNG government. But are we thinking and working politically in the environment we face with DFAT as development professionals?
Thank you. I think I'll hold it there, and I might say everyone should go along to Seb's talk. What time's your talk? 3 p.m. and it's also on adaptive management, isn't it?
You're going to talk this afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe for those interested, we can continue some of this conversation later because we're just going to run out of time now. But yeah, there's a plug. And now we can answer those last two questions.
Thanks, David. I think that most of our staff in the office in Port Moresby think and work politically all the time in certain dimensions. My bottom line is that the thinking politically is not translated into working politically explicitly in terms of our programming. I think our staff know full well the pressures that the Papua New Guinea government are under, and they know full well the strategic importance of PNG to Australia. They know full well the pressures that the High Commission staff are under. So in that sense, they think and work and breathe and live politically. But we're not talking about that. We are talking about the extent to which an understanding of events, dear boy, events, what happens on the ground. We are talking about the extent to which what happens on the ground, the extent to which we can deliver our development objectives, are every day, every week affected by stuff that happens, and the extent to which they respond appropriately. We're not talking about people thinking about, oh, the High Commission have got to deliver this report to Canberra. They do that all the time. We are talking about the impact on programming. And that's where I think there's a big gap.
Just quickly on responding to David, I think there is some of the concerns or issues that Senator Wong raised yesterday. I think there is an acknowledgement, and the pendulum is swinging back to, and there's an acknowledgement that the development capabilities in the integrated department are not what they were four or five years ago under OZE, and I think there is quite a strong push to put a re-emphasis in the workforce planning. I mean, in the broader bureaucratic environment, I think development is returning in that sense. I take your points about a lot of the lessons, and this is one of the concerns that Ben raised earlier about the coalitions for change replicability. You know, when we're dealing with high capacity environments like the Philippines and Nigeria, and looking at programs like that and the lessons like from those programs, and talking about the Pacific, it is just such a different world, and the social, political, economic forces and human capital issues, simply because of scale, they're so fundamentally different. So I take your point, and it's for further discussion the afternoon's panel.
Does anyone have anything desperate they'd like to finish off with? Or, yeah, because I know there's the 3-minute aid pitch happening now, so we've got to vacate the room or let others in. We'll have the best seats.
Yeah, I just want to add to what Sakic is saying in response to Sam's points about coalitions for change, and the extent to which something like coalitions for change under Jaime's fantastic leadership, POP in Myanmar, a very different context. Very different context, with a very, very different team leader who plays it very, very different to Jaime, but with equally successful results. So we shouldn't just say, oh, well, coalitions for change is led by such an individual that it'll never be replicated. That's not the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've run out of time, but thank you. If everyone could please join me in thanking our panellists. Thank you.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media.